and welcome back to Backcountry. Come in, take a seat.
How's it going, man?
Good, man, thanks. It's nice to be out in the sunshine this summer, enjoying...
Yeah, it is summertime, and it's fucking cooking.
That's right. We've entered summer now, and that means, of course, it's blockbuster season.
Yeah, what's on at the box office right now?
There's a lot. There's been... there's the big ones we're going to be getting onto later, is Inception. We both want to see that.
Yep, Inception.
And we got Toy Story 3.
Toy Story 3, yeah. The Last Airbender.
Yeah.
The Last Gearbender. what else is there? The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, that looks good. A bit of Nick Cage. He's a hot property at the moment. I mean, it might not be a great role for him, but he's... Another Nick Cage film this year.
Mm-hmm.
Loads, mate.
Yeah, he's prolific. I'll give him that.
Good. No, I think he's making a comeback. And it's also got that Jay Baruchel, who's, I don't know if you saw She's Out of My League this year.
No.
Sort of romantic comedy. It's good stuff. It's good stuff.
Yeah. For
any of you out there who saw stuff like Role Models or that I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell, it's the same kind of humour. Yeah, it's good stuff. Formulaic, but I'll get some laughs out of you.
Ah, cool.
Yeah. And,
Twilight Eclipse.
Woohoo!
Hooray! For gay vampires.
Yeah, that's one for the tweens, I think. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's in there. It's blockbuster season, though. There'll always be that.
Yeah, there'll always be drops in the blockbuster.
Yeah.
Months.
and obviously, competing with Toy Story 3, a couple of other animations. We've got Shrek Forever After.
Meh.
E.g. Shrek 4.
Done with Shrek.
Yeah, I have seen that, actually. I just thought it was poor.
Yeah?
Yeah, I did laugh, but it tended to be cheap laughs, opposed to some of the first two, I thought, were a lot more clever. You know, the laughs they were using, kind of like pop cultural references, they were really good.
Yeah.
Like when they had the gingerbread man, you know, having his Godzilla scene walking through the town.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
He steps on one Starbucks and everyone runs out like, oh my God, with their like cappuccinos in hand, run across the road into the other Starbucks for safety.
yeah.
You know, real good like social commentary. But I thought Shrek Forever After was just a series of cheap laughs in a It's a Wonderful Life remake and not as good.
Well, I heard from you. That it was...
Good source.
Yeah. the best. That it was like all the main characters from the previous films just weren't in there.
Yeah, they all play like little cameo roles rather than, you know, real character integration and development.
Yeah, and why would you do that?
Yeah, it was...
What's the point?
Oh, well, Shrek's supposed to be the main character. He's gone off to Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah.
To say, like, oh, I wish I was never born, or something stupid like that. So he gets transported to a reality where he doesn't exist. Everything's different, right? He's not met Fiona, he doesn't have kids.
Right.
He's not going through his midlife crisis. It's just boring. I laughed a bit, but I was just happy it ended at the end.
Well, midlife crises are boring as fuck as well. Like, why would you want to watch that on screen with a big fat green man who looks like Wayne Rooney?
Yeah. yeah, nice. Yeah, I think they just run out of ideas, so they decide to go that route. And unfortunately, they've just gone too far. I don't think it's going to translate with the younger audience. But, I mean, we might as well move on to Toy Story then, because I thought that was a lot better handled. I love that film.
Toy Story, one of the films of the year for me already.
Yeah.
I'm a big Toy Story fan.
I even
bought my Woody shirt from Bellina the other
really?
Day.
Really? Oh, yeah. Sweet.
Yeah, it's just got Woody on the front skipping along and it just says Woody underneath. It's brilliant.
If I can find me a pair of boxers with some Woody on, that'd be pretty good. I'd purchase those. Mm. Dollars well spent.
Yeah, well, Toy Story 3 for me is how you end a trilogy. How you end something that you've grown up with.
Yeah, because we have. I mean, the first one came out, I might be a few years off, but I think around 97.
Mm.
And I would have been about 10.
I'd have been 13.
Yeah.
But it's still young enough to really resonate for me.
Yeah, I mean, that was an age where I was probably moving away from, like, my Batman and X-Men toys and Legos onto, like, you know, I just bought a Nintendo 64, obviously. I was, like, glued to the TV. But, you know, we were still, like, emotionally connected to our toys. And
yeah.
That's what the beauty of the Toy Story franchise does. It makes you kind of nostalgic for those days when you used to get home and break into your toy box and just have these like great imaginative play sessions with your toys.
Yeah, where does that imagination go, man? Shit.
Well, it seems to be channeled into like glowing rectangles that we seem to live our lives by now, like your iPhone, your PlayStation 3, and your computer.
And I wouldn't say that's a bad thing, but no, it's just
evolution, isn't it?
Yeah. I love what the Toy Story has done, because it's not just about all nostalgia and, like, ooh, is technology getting in the way of all the good stuff that was old, like, you know, Buzz makes Woody obsolete, almost.
Yeah, that was introduced in the first one, wasn't it? Like, dealt with, that's what the first one was so great about it. It was, like, a new generation of toys that were, like, had more, it wasn't just, like, the sheriff, because Buzz had all the bells and whistles, you know, the laser gun, the pop-out wings. He was shiny, he was new. He represented the future by being a futuristic space ranger, whereas Woody was the past, you know, this old Western sheriff.
Mm.
That was very cool.
Oh, with the drawstring. There's a snake in my boot.
Reach for the sky.
Oh, I tell you what, every time I hear that in a Toy Story film, it sends shivers down my spine, mate. I really, like, you know, animated films, people generally lump into the it's all for kids.
I disagree with that wholeheartedly. That's what Pixar are so good with all their films, especially the Toy Stories, but with last year's Up as well.
Oh, what a beautiful film.
Yeah, and I think that had all the adults in the cinema, probably the kids as well, like just welling up a little bit at so many moments, because they really know how to tug on the heartstrings.
Oh, well, with Up, I cried in that. I almost cried at the end of Toy Story 3.
I have to say, I was welling up.
It was just such a beautiful, beautiful end to a trilogy. Like, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone because it's still out.
Yeah.
But, just such a tender moment at the end.
They handled it well because, as you said, it's sort of closing the franchise. Like the first one we mentioned very quickly that it was dealing about, you know, change and like new stuff in the future. Second, I don't really remember much from it. I remember there was the guy with the nugget. It was about the guy from the cereal packet, isn't it?
Oh, that was in number two, right?
Yeah.
The Prospector.
Yeah, the Prospector. And then, like, introduce Jesse and the horse.
Trigger. No, not Trigger. I'm thinking about Only Fools and Horses.
I've seen that in Young.
Bullseye. There's so many brilliant characters in Toy Story. That's what works for Toy Stories as well, is it's an ensemble cast.
Yeah, yeah. And some great voice acting. I don't know if you recognise any, but the pig is, the piggy bank is, did you ever see Cheers?
Cheers.
It's Norm from Cheers, the postman.
Oh, is it?
He's the voice, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
And Mr. Potato... Oh, no. Sorry, I lied. That's Mr. Potato Head, I think.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah. Or is it the pig? I can't remember. He's one of them.
Okay. Well, yeah, the thing that Pixar did that DreamWorks didn't is make toys, make characters believable, make them part of your family, like kids who have grown up with Toy Story. At the end of Toy Story 3, you're emotional because you're never going to see these again.
Yeah, I mean, that was going through my mind as well, that, you know, we're kind of saying goodbye to these characters.
We are, and
it was a nice farewell.
Well, it was a beautiful farewell. They handled it with so much grace and so much panache.
I thought it was well done. But just coming back quickly, what I was saying before about themes, without giving away anything, the third film, Toy Story 3, deals with sort of themes of abandonment and growing up and moving on, because you know, in the quite well, the beginning of the film, you know, we see our favourite characters again, like Woody, Buzz, Jesse and Bullseye.
Yeah.
Ham's back there. You got the potato heads.
Slinky dog.
And the aliens.
Those little aliens.
Yeah. And very quickly, it's established that they're in a big play session. So it's real imaginative. There's a lot of action going on. Mm. But yeah, it's Andy playing with his toys. Andy's the, if you don't remember, he's the main kid, Woody and Buzz's owner. Well, all of their owner. And it's very clever cinematic device they use, very similar to Up, that they use a sort of a montage of memories to show a passage of time.
We're going to need a montage. And you said passage of time as well. Just absolutely. That's a quote from Team America.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. To show you that would take too long, we're going to need a montage.
Even Rocky had a montage.
There's a lot of things happening at once.
Yeah. I mean, they take the piss out of it in Team America, but it's a cinematic device that's used well, used a lot because it's
effective.
It's effective, yeah. And in Toy Story, like in Up, it's really good. It was nicely done. And they use technology as well. Mm. So basically, you fast forward to the future, and Andy's a big kid. He's hardly a kid anymore.
Gone off to college.
You know what that means? It means sort of deciding what you want to take and what you don't. We've been through the process. Some of you out there, I know, have. Some of you might be looking forward to that after this summer.
Mm.
If we have that many listeners of that age.
Yeah. And what happens is, you know, there's I guess growing up and getting older and you know, losing people along the way, like even the toys did. They lose friends along the way, yeah. And
it's very analogous to real life as well, like especially those of you like us who've had a Hong Kong upbringing. Hong Kong's very transient. So people have come and gone. I mean, my best friend when I was 5 left when I was 6. Mm. And so on and so forth. And I'm quite fortunate to still have some friends that I've known since childhood. But, you know, you lose people along the way.
Yeah, Hong Kong, people disappear. And in Toy Story, lots of people disappear in that film. And they handle loss really well.
Mm.
I mean, there's a lot in there for the adults to analyse, but for the kids as well, it's like, what Pixar do really well is draw you into their movie and make you love these characters, absolutely fall in love with them. And I've never had that with the DreamWorks film. DreamWorks has always been like, ha, cheap laugh, ha, 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 like Shark's Tale. And
Okay. So, yeah, Shark's Tale I thought was poor, especially since it was following on to Finding Nemo, which was much better.
And
didn't Shark's Tale have like Christina Aguilera and some loser like R. Kelly playing characters?
No, Queen Latifah.
Queen Latifah, whatever, it's gimmicky. Rather than properly fleshed out characters.
And Jolie was in there as well.
Angelina Jolie?
Yeah.
Typical.
I'm a slag. And, I got no love for that woman. And Pixar Studios, one thing that I've always liked about Pixar is from the very first DVD that I ever got of them.
Do you remember what that was?
I think it was Toy Story.
Nice.
And they had DVD extras.
Yeah.
And they talked to a lot of the staff. And they talked to the head honcho at all the heads of the department. And what they were saying about Pixar was, we are a family-orientated company. What we do is we make films for families. What makes us special is that we spend time with our families also. The people who work at our company, they work 9 to 5. They work at an incredible rate. There's so much to be done. This, like, making a film is a horrific process.
Huge collaborative process. Yeah. I mean, you've got people doing, especially on animation, the division of labor will be huge again. You have different people animating just backgrounds, people doing probably eyebrows of characters.
even doing texture of grass.
Yeah,
if you think about a film like Toy Story, like, it's so beautiful, like, just detailing.
I'd forgotten how how great it was just to see the seam on Woody's hat, on his cowboy hat, like, and things like that, and like the hair of Barbie is all like, you know, you can see the strands and stuff.
And just see how well groomed they all are.
Yeah.
I mean, they're beautiful films, and the people were saying that at Pixar they work differently than other film companies because they are family. They make films for families, not kids. Families.
Yeah.
So if they're at work all day, it's taking time away from their family time. How can they make good films for families if they don't know? Or they don't spend time with their own. So from 9 to 5, they work flat out balls to the wall. They have theme days.
Yeah.
Yep. Every day is a theme day.
That's so cool.
So they do
mustache
costumes,
Mondays.
Yeah, things like that. Hawaiian shirts on Fridays, that sort of thing. True. I mean, just to go with the cliche. And I think what they said they did once a week was they have group competitions. So the different departments, like say the 3D animation department, will be pitted off against, like say
the 2D,
or the storyboarders, or the writers, sweet. And they all get together in this big warehouse that they have, and they have competitions just to keep their minds fresh.
Yeah.
And one of them that they had on the DVD extra was creating these 10-foot paper airplanes and judging who could throw theirs the furthest from the top of the warehouse. And
that's literally one of my life ambitions. I can pile a list with a friend about things I want to do. I've got to go work for Pixar.
Yeah, and what Pixar said about these activities is they keep their minds fresh, they keep them creative, they keep it a lot. You know, there's a lot of fun there.
Yeah, well, a bit of friendly competition,
they create it into a family themselves. And they said at the end of the day, when it hits 5, there is a fucking huge horn that goes off, like in all the departments.
Well, like a Fred Flintstone type, like
that kind of thing. Yeah, and what happens is it hits that time of the day, and they've got to stop working and go home. Anybody who's caught doing overtime loses pay.
Really?
Yeah. They enforce it because they want people to go spend time with their families. Mm. Whether if they have kids, go spend time with your kids, your wife, your husband.
Yeah.
If you don't have kids, go spend it with your mum, your cousins, your uncles.
I see. Yeah, I see. So they're encouraging them to take personal time and not just lose themselves in work.
Because how can you viably make a film for a family if you yourself can't?
Well, if you're so isolated that you're not interacting with those you love. No, that's a really beautiful philosophy.
And it's in all their films. Every single film that Pixar have done, there's it's all about family values, friendship, love.
The simplest things, but they're the deepest as well, and they resonate. That's why they resonate with not just kids, but with adults. That's another thing about Pixar films, that they work on different levels, and they appeal to kids for different reasons that they appeal to adults, right?
Yeah.
It's like Finding Nemo, the kids loved the whole fleshed-out environments, that it was like, wow, it looks like a real fish, except it was obviously a cartoon, you know?
Hmm.
And all the turtles are like, birdacious dude, like the kids love it. It's like, oh, he's supposed to be like a surfer guy.
Mm.
But then adults liked it as well because they can relate to losing their kid in a shopping mall, thinking, oh my god, you know, where's my son? Like, have you seen my son? Like, I left him in parking shop, and I just went to get, you know, a bit of milk, because that's what happens in Finding Nemo, right?
And you turn your head and bam, they're gone.
Yeah, and kids might be able to relate. Maybe they don't understand so much why the parents are so upset. It's like, oh yeah, they lost the kid. But if you think about what Nemo was going through, he was just on this crazy adventure, like, oh, this is so cool. And that's probably what a kid's thinking as well when they wander off. It's not like, I'm going to wreak havoc for my parents. It's just like, ooh, a shiny light in the distance. And they walk off to have a little wonder about what's the light.
And to get back to Toy Story 3, I think that's in there as well.
Definitely.
I mean,
well, another thing that they offered in Toy Story thematically is a new start.
Oh, yeah.
Because the toys that that do get a new start.
So Toy Story has that in there, you know, feelings of loss, of losing people that you really cherish, and everyone can relate to that. You lose best friends in your life, you lose friends, family along the way,
yeah.
You lose pets, you lose things that you love, like maybe a toy or a phone. Or
they feel like they've
been abandoned,
yeah. Yeah. And they have to deal with that. So when an opportunity for a new start is presented to them, a lot of the toys, it kind of splits the camp, but a lot of them are well up for going off for a new start. Because I think they can see the relationship with Andy's coming to an end. But it's real hard for, you know, Woody especially, because he's so loyal to Andy. You know, I think it's safe to say that from the beginning, Andy's always had a soft spot for Woody. You know, Woody was the favourite. He was the hero.
He was the sheriff
who comes in and saves the day and gallops off with Bo Peep or whoever in the sunset, right?
Well, Woody made up a huge part of his childhood from Toy Story 1 to Toy Story 2. Even when Buzz comes along, he's had cowboy hats, little horses that he's ridden on,
you know,
made out of a broomstick. He's had wallpaper. He's always had a Woody poster on his wall.
That's right.
It's not giving anything away if I say in Toy Story 3 there's a bit where Woody's looking around the room and he finds a picture of Andy when he's younger and he's got Buzz and Woody in his hand and he's looking at the camera like, this is the best time of my life. And everyone's had one of those moments where you're like, shit, that really was a beautiful, beautiful time of my life and I'm never going to have that again.
Mm.
And Pixar handle it so well. I'm getting emotional thinking about it now, because I adored the Toy Story series. It was funny, it was well made, it looks absolutely stunning.
I remember from the first, it was one of the first fully animated films, and do you not remember how cool it was to see a fully 3D film? I mean, I think it was made in association with Disney. The Toy Stories. So with Disney, we've been used to some great classics like The Jungle Book, one of my favourites, Alice in Wonderland.
Lion King. Aladdin.
Yeah. Aladdin, which I rewatched recently as well. If some listeners out there might know. we've had some treats, but then to see a fully animated film was like mind-blowing. And the level of detail was sick. It was...
Pixar's flagship was Toy Story, wasn't it?
That was the first film that kicked it off.
Wonderful film. Please go watch it. And if you've seen it, go watch it again. Take like your niece or your cousin or, you know, someone you know, just fucking go watch it.
I went to go see it with some mates of mine, so it was like four of us guys. It was a good time. Four of us, like, you know, we were sharing the laughs, and like, even I know I was welling up a bit at the end. It's great to see with family, with friends. It'd be a great date film because, I mean, come on, let's face it, girls love a guy who can feel. He's got a bit of emotion in it, right? So, you know, they look over and they see you well enough. You're in there, baby.
And if you're a little bit self-conscious, you could just blame it on the glasses.
Yeah, it hurt. I'm not used to the 3D.
And just to round off about Toy Story, it's had one of the best shorts that they've done.
Yeah, that's one thing I love.
Day and night.
That's one thing I love about Pixar. They always put out a short before the film.
Yeah, just to keep the kids glued to the seats.
I think it's just a very cool thing because back in the day, they used to get an A film and a B film. I remember my dad talking about going to cinema. And the B film was always lower production values, sort of B-list stars, and it was always real short. And it was just a nice little prologue into the film. Usually they had nothing to do with the A film.
Yeah.
But I think Pixar kind of is a nice homage to that. And they get to be real experimental. You know the Pixar logo? The I in Pixar is the lamp. Yeah? Well, that lamp originated from, I think, was it Toy Story was the first? That was the short film for it. It was a Big Daddy lamp or Mama lamp. And a little baby lamp.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
It's really cool. Like, Pixar, awesome. Pixar, I've got it down. Like, and from what you said about their philosophy, their business philosophy, I think that's awesome. And it speaks volumes about the films they try to make.
Mm. and it shows that they care about what they do,
yeah.
And they care about their staff, they care about the people that are watching the film, and Toy Story 3 for me is Pixar's masterpiece. I can't praise Toy Story as a trilogy enough.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly can't. For me, it's better than the Godfather trilogy. And that's going out on a limb.
That is. I think they're very different.
Criticize me all you want, but I think as a trilogy, Toy Story succeeds where Godfather doesn't.
Ah, mate.
Godfather 3, no,
I just
no,
don't
thank
even
you.
Think. I just don't even think they're comparable, to be honest. The Godfather is aimed at a different audience for one thing, and it deals with a lot of different things.
It is, but let's not go off topic. I just want to say Toy Story is one of my favourite trilogies of all time, and
yeah.
I don't see anything trumping it in a long time.
Yeah. I think it's from the statement you just made, like, it obviously has a big effect on you, and I agree with you that it's awesome. I think they rounded it off nicely, and it's a nice way to say goodbye to it, and I don't think they need to revisit it. I think it would potentially ruin it if they tried to. So, quite happy to send it off with a nice laugh, a chuckle, and a little sob.
Yeah. I'm going to miss Woody.
I'm going to miss Woody and Buzz and the whole gang. They taught me a lot.
They did. And a big thanks to Pixar, really. Beautiful, beautiful films.
They've done themselves justice. Anyway, I think it's time to say goodbye to that section of the podcast because we've been rambling on for a little bit.
Yeah, so goodbye, Toy Story.
Thanks for the memories.
yeah, thanks for the memories. Speaking of beautiful films, just saw Inception.
I just saw it for a second time, actually, on Sunday, my birthday.
Nice. Happy birthday, sir.
Cheers, pal.
I've seen it twice as well. Saw it again last night. And I think we saw it twice for different reasons.
Well, for me, it was actually quite... It was two showings in a short period of time. I watched it on the Friday night with some friends, and it was absolutely amazing. I wasn't blown away, but I was gripped. I was captivated the whole way through. It's an incredible concept, but I think it's a film that requires multiple viewings because I don't know about you, but for me, the second viewing was a different experience because I could sit back. I knew all the rules already. And I didn't have to process everything so much. I could sit back and absorb the story more.
Mm. I think the second time for me, I wanted to watch it because there were certain parts that bugged me. And I wanted to see if I was just being a dick for being a dick's sake or, you know, whether I actually did enjoy the film. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it was so overhyped for me.
Yeah, it was. And this is something I'm very afraid of, especially since we are talking about summer films, blockbusters. Blockbusters especially, but this applies to all films, that trailers can ruin films, in my view. They can build them up so much that it's hard for films to live up to them. And I think Inception, well, from what you're saying, it sounds like it's become a victim of its own marketing and PR. For some.
Yeah. I would say that I blame most of the overhype from dickheads on Facebook.
The people you decided to call friends.
Yeah, basically. Because every time I logged on for the past couple of weeks, it's been out in America for a while, it's been out in England for a while, and every time I logged on to Facebook... Inception is the best film ever. Yeah. Inception is like, it's like the Godfather of our generation. Oh, it's fucking amazing. And I'm going, okay, so it must be mind-blowing. And I watched it, and I wasn't blown away, which left me feeling like I've been cheated.
Oh, I'm sorry. It has been very hard to escape everyone's status update. It has been, just saw Inception, amazing, or lost for words. I'm sorry that it seemed to have hampered your viewing experience.
Kind of.
Did you then feel, upon a second viewing, having already seen it and having some of your expectations and prejudices, like, either broken or reaffirmed, did you find it easier to watch on a second viewing?
I found it easier to watch, and I found a lot more things explained. And I have a huge man crush on Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Especially after 500 Days of Summer.
Yeah.
Which is a brilliant film.
Him, for me, he's an up-and-comer.
He's ace, yeah.
I like him a lot.
Well, he has actually, he's done very well for himself on this sort of indie circuit and smaller film festivals. He's been in a couple of films like Brick. We've mentioned that before.
We have.
Kind of a psychological thriller. And a couple of others that escape me now, but he plays like a rent boy type character in one of them. I can't remember what that's called.
Yeah, I've heard about that film, and he's supposed to be absolute genius in
that. Won a lot of praise for that, yeah.
Yeah, he's an up-and-comer.
Apart from that, it's got some great characters. We're talking Ken Watanabe. He plays Saito, the Japanese businessman.
Yeah, Saito was a brilliant character. All the characters really well-rounded. But there was something that was bugging me the whole time in the first film, and the first showing, and the second time I saw it, I have to feel like I'm struggling for words here. First viewing of Inception, I enjoyed the film, but there's something not quite right sitting with me.
What do you mean? I mean, you've said that several times. Like, can you clarify?
I felt like I was being cheated by trick cinematography and special effects and everything to cover up a bad film.
That's quite a statement, because I feel quite the opposite, to be honest.
Mm, well, let me explain. I watched it the second time, and I still maintain that it's a very good film, but I feel like the opportunity was missed. A big opportunity was missed.
Opportunity to...
Well, people will disagree with me on this, and they can disagree with me all I want. This is just an opinion. But I felt that the ability to go into dreams wasn't utilised well. I felt it was very, very linear, very, very structured. I didn't think it was bizarre enough. I didn't feel at times that we were watching people in a dream. I felt like we were just watching
sort of just other scenes from films, or
yeah, especially the snow scene.
Yeah.
The only thing that really made that dreamlike for me was the bit when I can't really say. But there were two big moments in there for me that made me feel, okay, this is a dream.
Yeah.
Apart from that, it just felt like your bog standard action flick.
Yeah, but to be honest, okay, it was a huge jump in the not a huge jump in the narrative, but yeah, they've gone into a different scene, and it's very different from the last one. What I thought was good. I mean, it is essentially a heist film, right?
Like, it is a heist.
Like they build a crack team to get a job done. Things go wrong, as they inevitably do in a heist film. But, you know, they find a way to get done what they need done if they can. But it's wrapped in like sort of like a psychological thriller presentation. And, yeah, there's sci-fi elements, because I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying it's to do with dreams. And they spend a lot of the film in the dream world. In people's heads, yeah.
And they spend a lot of the movie talking about time and...
Mm.
And
playing with time.
Yeah, and perception.
Yeah.
And...
Well,
Don't get me wrong. The philosophy in there and the ideas are there. Mm. And...
Concepts, were very, very ahead.
Fleshed out.
Yeah, and Nolan's been developing this for years, apparently.
10 years.
Like, really working on this. This is his little baby project. Like, all through the Batmans, he was playing with this concept. Memento as well, which, again, was like... That was more non-linear, but, again, was playing with your perceptions of what's going on.
Indeed.
I think that was another that took a few viewings for me to really wrap my head around and appreciate.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant
film.
The
thing is he spent 10 years doing this. And he said he didn't feel he was ready to make it. He wanted to do some big blockbusters.
Yeah.
So he did the Batman series.
Prestige as well.
Yeah, and Prestige. And they all did very well. And they are up there in some of my favourites. You know, Dark Knight for me is like the embodiment of a comic book film for me, and I'm a comic book fan. So.
And it was a brilliant revamp of what was it?
Of a stale
dead
series,
horse. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were flogging a dead horse with like Batman and Robin.
And what's happened with Inception is I think he's got all the ideas there. I think it's well acted. I think it's well scripted. I just feel that they didn't take the opportunity to really fuck with perception and
when they were in the dreams,
yeah, and what reality really is.
Yeah.
Because if they're going to delve into people's heads and into people's dreams, I didn't think it was weird enough. And,
well,
and people are going to say,
does it have to be weird though?
Well, that's the thing.
Were you hoping for like a sort of Terry Gilliam's Brazil or Eternal Sunshine, Spotless Mind type? Like weirdness and distortion.
Well, if he was trying to be accurate with his dreams, then yeah, because your dreams are erratic. They're impulsive.
They're not all of them. I've had dreams about just being in school or just being at work or just walking down the road.
Indeed.
You know, I've had crazy dreams and I've had some slightly erotic dreams.
Yeah.
But a lot of my dreams are just very standard.
You may have had more standard dreams. That's perfectly fine, but every dream sequence in that film seems to be very structured. And, okay, people are going to argue with me and say that there's an architect who's creating these worlds. But within the structures, they're saying, well, people can influence them by shooting their projections in there. Leonardo
yes.
DiCaprio has his influence the worlds at times.
Well, the idea...
And there's moments where weird, a little bit weird, but they weren't, like, bizarre. And people do have bizarre dreams. I just didn't think they allowed for that to occur.
Mm.
And people may be listening to this and thinking, Paul, it's such a small thing. Can't you just enjoy the film? No. it's something that bugs me, and you know, I should be allowed to gripe.
You should. I'm glad that you have, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because I actually disagree with you.
Okay.
I understand that he had a license to really mess with perceptions and question the nature of reality. I do think that was addressed in that questioning the nature of reality, especially for viewers out there who've seen the end of the film. That leaves you with a big hanging question.
Oh, indeed.
But even throughout the film, it can be argued that everything that's going on might not be what it seems like. It's hard to say without giving it away, but basically, a film is much like a dream in that very often, as Leonardo DiCaprio says to Ellen Page, DiCaprio is obviously the sort of ringleader, and Ellen Page is the young architect they bring upon. The architect is the one who constructs these dreams for their missions. As he says to her, with a dream, you never start from the start, you get thrown into the middle, right? And he asks her, how did we get to this cafe? And she's like, oh, it's simple. And she realizes they're in a dream. And same with films. Very often you just get to start thrown into them. And that's how Inception starts again. He wakes up on a shore in the middle of the film, sort of. Sorry, I'll just take a moment to collect my thoughts because I was arguing against that you saying he didn't go far enough with it.
I've
lost myself.
the levels
I'm in limbo.
The levels of the dream worlds are there. Questioning reality is there.
Yeah.
I'm not challenging that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying he had the opportunity to really put something vibrant on the screen. Something like to really show the whole scale of what dreams can be. But he only showed one element. He showed...
Which element?
Structured, linear, normal-esque dreams.
I think that was addressed in the talk of subconscious, that everything that happens in your dream is not within your control. It's in your subconscious mind. The subconscious mind is like you breathing. You don't know you're breathing until you think about it, and then you're conscious and you're controlling
it. The bit about, what is it Arthur says? He says... I tell you to not think about elephants. What are you thinking about now?
Elephants.
Elephants.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know where I'm going with that.
Well, basically, what I was going to say about your point was that how it works with a dream is that one person dreams. Like, it has a lot of parallels with The Matrix as well.
It does.
Yeah, I think that was part of an inspiration for him as well. But that you have a dreamer, and then you have sort of passengers on the dream. But then you have a subject, and it's the subject's subconscious that populates the film. You might have an architect that gives it a framework, but it's the subject's subconscious that does it. So while it might seem to you that it wasn't bizarre enough, that he didn't develop it like, you know, that it wasn't like samurais flipping about while he was in a spaceship trying to shoot him down until he jumped out, you know, Indiana Jones style with a whip and a lightsaber, yeah. Right? It's because very often your subconscious mind is just dealing with your everyday shit. It's how we deal with it. That, like, in our dreams, we flesh out just normal situations. And they might be very different and bizarre. But also, don't you find when I dream, when the dream gets weirder and weirder and weirder, is when I start to lose my grip on it. And it's usually at the weirdest point that I wake up in a dream.
That's the case. And why wasn't that incorporated into that then? Why couldn't he...
They did it parts.
When?
For example, when there were like outside influences in the... Ellen Page realizes she's dreaming and shit starts exploding, it's because once you realize your reality, once you start questioning your reality, then that's when things become unstable.
Her dream was deconstructed.
Yeah.
But the build-up wasn't really there. People start looking at you funny.
Once you start messing with... When they realize things aren't quite right.
When you start messing with the dream, fair enough. But where's the part, like you just mentioned, when things start getting really bizarre that kicks you out? Why couldn't they have a kick like that when, like, just to bring that in there?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that the film is incredibly terrible for not having it in. I'm just saying he missed an opportunity.
Yeah, you're saying that's a sort of fatal flaw. I very much understand that.
I also feel that...
Can I just ask you very quickly, do you think that would have helped the storyline? Because it would have been very difficult to tell the same story, I think, if it had got too bizarre.
Well, I'm not saying go over the top with having like elephants swimming through the air grab on hold and suddenly you're in Sergeant Pepper's fucking world.
But if you think about it, yeah, okay, I understand that. I don't want to talk about the film for those who haven't seen it. But they rely on the subjects believing that it's not a dream. That's how they operate. That's how they extract the information they need.
Yeah.
Because they need them to believe that they need them to believe what's going on in order for them to successfully complete the mission, in order for DiCaprio, who's playing a guy called Dom Cobb, and his team to complete their missions. So I understand how your perceived flaw of the film, but I think that had they gone that route, it would have been very difficult to tell the story that Nolan seems to have wanted to tell.
Yeah.
That's my only comment about what you're saying about that.
Okay. And that's fine. I'm just saying that I felt as if Nolan's missed an opportunity. I also feel like there's a few things that aren't utilized as well as they could have been.
Okay.
Or these things that aren't utilized as well as I thought they could have been. I didn't feel like some of the cast were given as much time on screen that they could have.
Okay. Anyone in mind?
Michael Caine.
Oh, yeah.
If you're going to have a part like that where there's a couple of minutes, just a few minutes for this character to appear on screen, okay, Michael Caine did beautifully with the job he was given.
But it's a small job, wasn't it?
It's such a small part. Yeah. Like, why would you waste Michael Caine?
That's
on that
true.
Part?
I mean, it must have been an expensive cameo, right?
Maybe he'd have done it for free or something.
True. He has collaborated on a lot of Nolan's films.
He has.
You know, he was Alfred in the Batman films. He was the mentor to the two illusionists in The Prestige.
In The Prestige, yeah. I just feel like, why put him in there? Why hype him up so much on the posters
and everything?
That was misconceiving. Is that
Deceptive? Deceptive, yeah. Possibly, yeah.
Because I was expecting Michael Caine to have a really big role in that film, and he didn't.
I think it's more that people expect someone of Michael Caine's caliber, that he's almost the go-to guy. Like, we need an old guy. He needs to be respectable and audience-friendly. Oh, Michael Caine. Or Morgan Freeman, depending on what the role is. They seem to be, like, wise old men.
Yeah.
And I suppose the character was a wise old man, but I can see what you mean. He was kind of wasted in that role.
He was.
Small part.
I would also like to have... There was the bit where they got... There's an elevator.
And lift.
A lift, yeah.
The American.
Sorry.
Twat.
And they're going through different layers of a certain person's mind. I'm not going to give anything away. I didn't feel like this was explained as well as it could have been. And part of me thinks maybe that was just tossed in there to give a bit more emotional depth to this other character.
I see. Well, Cobb.
Yeah, Cobb. And
It was really... Like, I remember it from the first viewing, and I remember seeing it. It was sort of like a collection of certain of his thoughts. But I didn't fully understand the concept until the second viewing. Which is, again, coming back to this multiple viewing.
Can you explain it to me, then? Because I was a bit lost.
It's the main character. DiCaprio plays Cobb. And he's had, like, trauma in his past, and his way of dealing with it is by sort of, like, self-medicating, I suppose, going into his own dreams and trying to deal with repressed emotion. That's what it was. It was repressed emotion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
it just felt jarring. It just felt like they were stepping away from the
trauma. That's what I felt on the first viewing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have issues with the film, but... To give it some praise, I thought the cast was stellar.
Oh, yeah, proper good. I mean, DiCaprio is hot.
He's hot property.
He's hot property, that's what I want to say, but I think I've got a bit of man crush on him as well. I went home after the second viewing and watched Shutter Island after dinner, and that's a proper good film as well.
I've watched the first 20 minutes of that, and it looks solid.
He's intense. He's a great actor. Unfortunately, the first time I came across him was Titanic, so I thought he was a massive twat after that. But then, you know, I watched his old films, like you were talking about...
What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Yeah.
Basketball Diaries.
Basketball Diaries, and then he was in Baz Luhrmann's...
Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, really good adaptation. For no one who's seen that, you can go watch that. And since he's been in great films...
Body of Lies.
Yep, Catch Me If You Can.
Catch Me If You Can.
Oh, that's a great film. Tom Hanks. And also Scorsese's remake of Infernal Affairs, The Departed.
The Aviator, Gangs of
Aviator,
New York.
Yeah. He's like you were saying... I think he'll be a real important actor.
He's going to be one of the icons of our generation.
That's it. Yeah.
I was saying to you earlier, he's going to have the same kind of caliber that James Dean had in his day.
Yeah, Cary Grant, all those classic actors.
Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
A
bit shady character though, Sinatra. Matt Feelings and that.
Who cares? Who cares? Yeah. DiCaprio's up there with the best of them for me.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, indie legend,
he's
getting the
recognition he deserves. Yeah. I mean, after last year's 500 Days of Summer, which was a wicked film, especially for anyone who's like gone through a breakup recently and needs to, you know, well, it's also a good film for those still in relationships and single people, but great film.
It's a fantastic film.
And it's got Zooey Deschanel, and I bloody love her. Oh.
Well, speaking of lovelies, there's Ellen Page and Marion Cotillard in this film.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Two really well-cast characters.
Very well-cast. Ellen Page can't do anything wrong in my eyes.
Yeah.
And Marion Cotillard just...
She is
nothing wrong in my eyes.
Female...
Sexuality. I am going to go back and rewatch La Vie en Rose because that could... speaking of which, they use Edith Piaf.
Edith Piaf's... Piaf. That's the music that they use for the kicks when they put the headphones on.
Yeah. Beautiful song.
And incidentally, didn't you were saying Marion Cotillard played Edith Piaf in...
In La Vie en Rose. That's why I'm going to go watch it again because it just brought back some good memories. So.
Sweet, I haven't seen that, so that's one I will watch. Didn't she win the... an Oscar or...
She won an Oscar
for that.
And a
probably like a BAFTA or a whole host of other stuff.
Yeah, she won loads for it. And she was well cast. Oh, she is frightening in that film. Absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
Tom Berridge is in there.
Yeah, he's got a small role, but he's
Pete
in there.
Pete Postlethwaite is in there. He's the dad of Fisher.
I thought that was Tom Berenger.
No, that's Pete Postlethwaite.
Oh, sweet. He's a good actor, yeah.
He is.
Very distinctive nose.
Yeah, very, very British actor as well.
Yes, yeah.
Cillian Murphy's in there.
Cillian Murphy, brilliant actor.
He's another up-and-comer as well.
And he's another Nolan collaborator again. He was the Scarecrow in the Batman.
And hopefully he'll get more of a shout-out in the next Batman films.
I hope so. He's one of my favourite actors of this generation. Also, we had Tom Hardy. He's the British actor who played Eames.
That character is fantastic.
He's a wicked... I think he's supposed to be portrayed as gay. He's very... Not effeminate, but, you know, the shirts he's wearing and stuff and his dialogue, like, when Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Arthur, is, like, taking out some of the militarized projections. And he's having a real trouble because they're sort of surrounded in the bunker, the warehouse. And then Eames comes over and it's like... Don't be afraid to dream bigger, darling. And he pulls out like a grenade launcher. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
Humour is really well done in this film.
It is. It's very... It's slick.
It's slick, man.
There's a moment between Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Ellen Page that had me in tears.
Oh, that was brilliant.
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil it.
Worth a try.
Yeah, we'll leave it there.
Yeah. But, and also Yusuf, the chemist, he was really funny.
He was funny.
Did you guys see that? There was a bit of tension between Eames and Arthur, which I really liked. They played that up.
Yeah. Arthur, for me, is the best character in that film.
Yeah.
And Maul. I really like Maul as well.
Yeah, they were great supporting actors. And then someone like Eames is good as well because he offers you a bit of cheek, a bit of colour. And that's why I say maybe he wasn't portrayed to be gay. But I like how they didn't have to make it... Maybe that was the actor's choice, maybe that was Nolan's choice. Yeah, they didn't have to make a big thing about it. You didn't have to like hit on any guys or anything. But that's just my personal view. I thought that was interesting. You had a lot of different personalities in that. Like Yusuf the chemist was kind of naive and geeky and stuff. You know, he was cool.
Cobb
is very complex. I love
Cobb. Cobb is brilliant as well.
And DiCaprio did a good job there.
He does steal the show. Mm. Ken Watanabe, Seter, is brilliant as
He's
well.
He's ace, yeah.
But
very gracious actor, I found.
To end, I have one more gripe I just remembered, speaking about the music.
Hey, your grievances, son.
Hans Zimmer, he did the music, he did the score for Batman Begins and Dark Knight.
Okay.
And he's done a lot of other big films, I can't remember any of them at the moment. And I lost a lot of dialogue at times in the film because the score was just so bloody loud.
Oh.
It was fucking loud. And that pissed me off as well.
That is a shame. I have to say I didn't. Maybe I'm thinking maybe it was the cinema you're in. They overdid their Dolby surround sound. I don't know.
Maybe
it is an issue with the score.
Maybe. I honestly don't know. But I felt Maul at times and Seta were drowned out a few times, and I missed key bits of dialogue, even on the second showing.
Fair dues, yeah.
And then the fat man next to me on the phone with it on his new iPhone
was
pissing me off as well.
You know, I had that as well. There was like a bit of someone talking, and it got to a stage where other people started talking. I was getting really annoyed. But then the friend I saw it with the second time was Cantonese. Was like, oh, those people were telling the other one to shut the hell up because it's ruining the film. And then two seats down from me was a mother and her son. Son was about 11 or something, so perhaps the film was slightly above him, but he just wasn't into it, and he was knocking his bottle of Coke against the drinks holder for about 10 minutes, and it just got to a stage where I had to say something. I looked over to him, but the mother saw me and sort of told him off. It's just a very typical thing. You always, in Hong Kong, you're getting phones go off, like boyfriends and girlfriends chatting away. It's bloody frustrating. Go see a shitty rom-com if you want to stick around and make out or talk, but this is like a proper hyped up film, which was really good as well. It was really intense. It ruined parts for me.
Was intense. A lot of things got in the way of me fully enjoying it, and that's not anybody's fault apart from those dickheads on Facebook that kept going on about it. Yeah, fuck yeah. You guys, actually. Yeah, I just want to say that. Yeah. All the people in Facebook who ranted and raved about it, go fuck yourself. Nah, I love you guys.
Yeah, it's just a shame. It's just a shame when things don't live up to the hype.
The hype got to it for me.
Anyway, I really enjoyed the film.
I did.
I thought it was visionary, and I thought it was quite clever how you need multiple viewings, because obviously that means dollar signs, my friend.
It does.
But anyway, I don't hold that against Nolan, because I think he's really gone out on a limb to make a summer blockbuster, which. For me, I'm hoping it's going to be number one at the end of the summer, like for takings. I hope it does well. I think it will, because it's blockbuster mentality. But they've tried to appeal to real cinephiles with like good cinematic technology, but a well intelligent film.
And there's a lot of philosophy in there as well.
Yeah, it's deep.
I just want to end by saying all the gripes that I have. Like, I did enjoy the film, and there are a lot of things that are positive about it that will make future films brilliant. Christopher Nolan has laid the bodywork for some brilliant, brilliant films, and
it's going to be hard to top this summer. I don't think it will be, but I'm looking forward to some challengers, later in the year.
Well, Christmas time. Yeah. Let's see what happens then.
Because I don't really think Twilight Eclipse is really going to push this one for
not at all.
Cinema lovers. Anyway, thanks for listening and lending us your ears.
Yeah, thanks for listening to us talk verbal diarrhea for a good hour.
Yeah, if you've enjoyed the show, feel free to join the Facebook page. It's This Is Backcountry HK.
Yep, you can search us there, or you can get us at our Twitter, which is Backcountry HK. You can also get us at our email address.
Yeah, that's thisisbackcountryhk@gmail.com. We'd love to hear any thoughts you got, any suggestions for the show. We love the feedback. In fact, we might start reading out some emails as well. Thank you very much for those of you who have emailed in.
Yeah, and you can catch us, just lastly, you can catch us at thisisbackcountryhk.podomatic.com.
Oh, yeah.
And you can subscribe to us at iTunes.
So. Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening.
Cheers for your support, guys, and we'll see you next time when you're back in backcountry.